Hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of our podcast, Is Breakfast Included? How are you? That's great. Today on the show, I sit down with Einar Peterson. Now, Einar is our production manager out here on Duran Duran. He's also an accomplished bass player who's played with the likes of the Dan Band, The Fray, as well as Kelly Clarkson. He sat down with us, filled us in on a little history of growing up in Texas, getting into the music scene, moving out to LA, and ultimately back to Austin to where he's ended up today. It was a lot of fun. Let's check it out. Anything you don't want to talk about?
No, I think it's anything goes.
All right. That yeah. Goat? You don't want to talk about the goat.
The goat? Yeah. The goat's fair play.
Okay. All right, man. Tell everyone who you are.
I'm Einar Peterson. I'm partially handsome and completely bald. So
bald like a seal.
Yeah, exactly.
Where are you from, man?
Born in New Orleans. Grew up, went to high school in south side of Houston, and I've lived in Austin most of the last 30-something years. Yeah. Lived in L.A. for a stint, about 10 years over there.
South side of Houston, where is that?
Missouri City, Texas, which is like southwest Houston. Went to high school in Sugar Land, home of the Imperial Sugar Plant. Yeah, where you get all your little sugar packets.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Yeah. I've been through Sugar Land. What was it like back then? Sugar Land's pretty nice now.
Yeah, Sugar Land's like posh now.
Yeah, they have a real nice venue there too.
Yeah, there's a couple of nice places there now. Man, when I grew up there, where that venue is and all of that development over there was kind of where we used to go just kind of get in trouble. It was just nothing, and it was a place to go drink beer when you were underage.
Yeah.
But now it's a thriving metropolis.
Yeah. Yeah, we did one of the first shows there.
Oh, really?
Duran did? Yeah.
Yeah, nice.
I think around 2017?
Yeah.
There was nothing around there.
In fact, the neighborhood that I lived in Missouri City, funny enough, it was a development. I think my parents moved there. My dad was in the oil business, and we moved from New Orleans to Houston. And it was a neighborhood that was built around two golf courses.
Uh-huh.
But nobody was there, and it was way outside of town. But Bum Phillips, the coach of the Houston Oilers back then, his wife was a real estate agent. And so the way that they built up this community was that Bum's wife got all the Oilers and a bunch of the Rockets and the Houston Astros back in that day to move over there. So it was an inexpensive suburb, but it just happened to have all these pro athletes that live there.
Yeah.
So, when I was a kid on Wednesday nights at the Quail Valley was the neighborhood that I lived in, the Quail Valley Country Club, every Wednesday night was Mexican night, and you could always see Earl Campbell there hanging out eating Mexican food.
Oh, right on. When you said Mexican night, I thought maybe just Mexican showed up.
Well, the Mexicans in the neighborhood definitely showed up. Yeah.
Right. So Earl Campbell, did you ever meet him?
I did. When I was, they used to hold the Herald's Menswear celebrity golf tournament in Quail Valley every year. And so all the, Oilers, Astros, Rockets that lived in the neighborhood would play. And when I was like 12, I was old enough to be one of the beer kids who would drive the golf cart around. And one day, I'm hanging out at, I can't remember which hole it was, but we would drive beer, and then every now and then we would take players and stuff.
Yeah.
But I pull up and waiting, and Earl's teeing off and everything. And Earl, he was super nice. He was like, kid, you want to give me a ride down the next hole? And he got in my cart with me, and I took him down the next hole. It was awesome. Yeah.
Right on. You are a bass player.
Yes.
Did you start out as a bass player? What got you into music?
Strangely enough, I'm from a musical family. My mom's dad was a Dixieland drummer back in like the 30s and 40s. And And then my dad's dad was a prolific writer for barbershop music.
Okay.
When my parents got married, my dad's dad befriended my mom's dad, of course, as you do, and turned out that not only was he a great drummer, he had a great tenor voice. So A&R One, my grandfather, got Bill, my mom's dad, into barbershop quartet. So as a child, my first memories of music was men singing harmony. And my dad's dad is, to this day, his music is some of the most used music in barbershop competitions all over the world. He is the second most contributor to barbershop music, right under Irving Berlin.
Wow.
Yeah.
And this is your dad's dad.
My dad's dad, my grandfather.
Your grandfather.
A&R One. I'm the third. So okay. My dad's junior and I'm three. Yeah. So there was always people singing. My dad's the oldest of a big family. His next brother, Leif, he sang in the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra for 15 years. He was on Carson a few times, sang for a couple of presidents. Still to this day, sings for a big band, jazz band that does, you know, they do Jazz Fest all the time. And then my dad's little brother, you know, grew up in the 60s. And he still, as a hobby, plays guitar and writes, like, you know, country songs, rock and roll songs. So,
okay. And your dad, is he?
My dad is an encyclopedia of music, but he's never played anything. That kind of missed him, but yeah. He
plays the radio really good.
Man, I tell you what, that guy, there's nobody that can argue the point that there's been no good music after 1965 than my dad.
Okay.
It's kind of awesome. Him and his buddy, who's my uncle, who married one of his sisters, his high school buddy, my Uncle Danny, they were kids, they grew up in New Orleans, and every summer they would pilgrimage to Texas so that they could get, you know, Bob Wills and Hank on the AM radio, and they were big country music fans in a world of jazz and rock and roll in the 50s. So, you know, that's where I guess it all kind of came to be. I have my grandfather's drums. He gave me his drums when I was a little kid, which I still have. 1938 Gretsch kit that I beat to shit when I was a little kid. Didn't know what they were until later in life. And now they serve as various art pieces in my house.
Right on.
But yeah, I had a guitar when I was a kid. I had drums when I was a kid. Bass was kind of an accident. I had a high school band like we all did. You know, we were the hot high school band. We'd play all the covers of the 80s, you know, Cult and U2 and Police and stuff. And one weekend we had a big party at Scanlon's Warehouse. one of the kids I went to school with, whose dad owned a sign shop, and they had a kegger blowout. And Chris Knight, my best friend in high school, was our bass player, and his grandfather passed away, and he was going to have to go, I believe it was to Amarillo, for the funeral. And so instead of canceling the gig, I spent that week learning U2 and Police and Cult songs and all that stuff. I was the singer in the band. And so we did that gig with me playing bass and singing. And that's when I sort of, like, you know, learning Sting lines and, you know, U2 tunes and all that stuff really made me, like, that's really what made me get the bug to really want to play bass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So did you pick that up pretty quick, playing and singing at the same time?
I guess so.
Or maybe in hindsight, it wasn't that good, but it's where it started.
Well, it was nothing. It wasn't anything that I thought, you know, was a daunting task.
Yeah,
you know, you kind of have that vibe when you're a kid like that, where just you're sort of fearless. But I think because of, you know, my upbringing and just being around music. I've been able to compartmentalize things. Like when I was 6-7 years old, I used to sit and in this chair that we had. It was the '70s, so it was this real plush, weird chair with these rolling sort of cushions around the back, and I would sit backwards in it and air drum to Kiss records and whatever else. But the compartmentalization of that stuff made sense. I always saw in my head that there was this guitar player doing this and that guitar player doing that, and the bass was doing this and the drums went around that. So I never thought that it was something that's supposed to be difficult to play something and sing something, mm-hmm. but later understood, like, wow, when you look at the great, like, Phil Lynott and, you know, Geddy Lee and all those guys that played bass and sang and played intricate bass lines, it is like singing two things at the same time. Bass is a linear instrument. It's a melodic instrument. So you've got rhythmic and harmonic things happening that are sometimes similar to what you're singing and sometimes completely different. So it became scary later.
Once you realized what you were doing.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So you were raised around music. You were a musician. You're an all-around musician, drummer, guitar player, bass player.
Yeah. I think I just always wanted to be involved. You know, I never set out to be like, I want to be a guitar player. I want to be a drummer. I want to be, yeah, actually that's not true. And this is something about me personally. I did want to be a drummer first. Mm-hmm. But there's an aspect of my personality that's very, I'm a ham. And I didn't like being in the back. I wanted to be in front. And that, I think, is what made me move away from that. But drums is sort of, if there's anything that I practice the most, it's drums. Just because that's the most fun. It's physical and everything else. But I do love being a bass player. I do love exploring territory in that you're by the book not supposed to be involved in. Yeah. I like having a giant pedal board. I like sounds. I like exploring sonic things.
Yeah. It's funny you say you're a ham because you play bass. Most of the bass players I know are the guys that are, they're usually the ones mugging out the best on stage.
Yeah. You have the opportunity.
And I always, anytime I see a band, I look over and I go, it's always the bass player.
Yeah. And we've done to bring up Geddy Lee a million times, but my favorite description of that is the way that Geddy and Alec, those guys call it throwing shapes. Uh-huh. When you do like stage moves or whatever, they call it throwing shapes. I think that's hilarious. But yeah, it wasn't necessarily that I ever wanted to be like, musicianship wasn't the top of my, on the top of my list. It was performance. And so, you know, I think I just gravitated to performance with something in my hands rather than performance in acting or dancing or something. Yeah.
Who's your guy?
Who's my guy?
Yeah.
Ooh, I got a couple of guys. Roger Waters, is always on the top of the list. I think a song like Another Brick in the Wall Part 2 might be the perfect bass line.
Wow.
His attention to when things stop is something that that song in particular, when you really, you can see anybody play that bass line. It's not difficult on paper, but nobody gets it right. His respect of the when things should go long, when things should stop, and space between the notes is incredible. His sense of melody in what's happening in his hands. His bass lines are some of my favorite. And that song can arguably be the best arranged song ever. That guitar solo is, I think, that Gilmore plays in that tune, one of the best. But I always, you know, Geddy Lee, like, that's, you know, I was a crazy Rush fan when I was young, still am. Listen to Permanent Waves is what I listen to every time I sit down on an airplane. I listen to that record start to finish. It's a weird thing. But but those are my guys. Pete Farndon from Pretenders. Another just like pocket guy. I think another one why am I drawing a blank? Adam Clayton from U2.
Yeah.
One of the most underrated bass players. His contribution to that music is insane. Another guy that when you know, it's not just about the notes. It's about where you put the silence. It's about where
the discipline.
It's where you move things around, and finding those little counter melodies that work with the melody of the song.
Yeah,
those are big guys. Geezer, I love Geezer.
That goes without saying. You didn't even have to tell me you love Geezer.
Dude,
everybody should love Geezer.
Yeah, it's sick. Phil Lynott, like I love Thin Lizzy. You know. I was a big fan of Doug Penick. Sonically, that guy explores sonic territory like nobody else. And one of the greatest rock and roll voices of all time.
Oh, man. Without a doubt.
Yeah.
You and I were talking earlier. You told me about this music store you worked at that produced, you know.
Dude, it's crazy. All the drummers that came, we were talking
about
Douglas.
John Douglas, who plays for Aerosmith right now.
That's crazy. Yeah, he was in Kick Tracy when I was still a teenager. Didn't work there yet, but I knew who John Douglas was for sure as a kid in Houston. Blas Elias worked at that shop. But yeah, it was one of those pre-Guitar Center stores where it was, that one was like a mom and pop shop on steroids. It was a giant place in Houston that was, you know, they had a big, it was when mail order was still a thing.
Right.
but you know, it was a huge drum shop, huge keyboard department, huge guitar department, huge pro sound department. It was just a bunch of dudes that were playing all the clubs in Houston. I started working there when I was 19. And I only started working there because I was in a band with the guy that ran the guitar department, the guy that ran the keyboard department, and one of the drum teachers. And the drum teacher guy, John Simmons, who I'm still friends with, I was friends with him. He got me into this band, and I showed up to our first rehearsal. I didn't have an amp. Right? I just had a bass, a Tokai jazz bass, a white Tokai jazz bass with a black pickguard. I wish I still had it, but I don't.
Yeah.
But I showed up with that and I just plugged straight into the PA, and they kept me in the band despite that. But then also gave me a job because I needed a bass amp. So that's how I got the job, by playing in a band with these guys that worked there. But they were, you know, they were all dudes like in their late 20s, early 30s that were in like a lot of cool bands in town. So it was just a wonderful experience for like, you know, somebody just like getting into the club scene and like, you know, seeing what it was all about. And it was awesome. Yeah. Was
so you came up and you came up in Texas, like you said, down near Houston. What do you think it is about Texas, man? Like around the time you were coming up, you had Galactic Cowboys, King's X, you know, bands like that. What do you think it is about Texas that just pushes out quality musicians?
Man, you know, because
now you're in Austin, you're surrounded by them.
Yeah, you know? And Houston in those days was awesome. There were so many cool bands. You know, I think. Maybe it just has to do with there's never, especially with Houston, there's not an identity. You're not supposed to be anything, so you can be anything.
Yeah.
There's a lot of different scenes that, at least in those days, were going on. There was, you know, there was an industrial scene. There was like great metal bands came out of Houston. Dead Horse is from fucking Houston.
Yeah.
Was
Hellstar from Houston?
Hellstar.
That's from Houston.
Hellstar's from Houston. I think DRI, a couple of guys there from Houston. Yeah. I may be wrong on that, but I think I'm right. I'm not sure.
Disclaimer.
Yeah. But you know, and this is also like in the eyes of someone that was brand new to everything.
Yeah.
So it did seem awesome. But I think maybe it romantically has to do with the aspect of Texas that is romantically outlaw, you know?
Yeah.
And there's a lot for a young kid to rebel against, you know? You are living in Houston, especially. Austin's like this little hippie oasis inside of this big giant red state.
Yeah.
Austin's got its own thing. I love Austin. Austin, there's no better place to find out who you are and who you want to be than Austin. But Houston, same way. But I think there was more to like give a middle finger to as a young, you know, rebellious kid who wanted to rock, you know? So I think maybe that plays into it.
The Ghetto Boys were from Houston.
Ghetto Boys were from Houston. Dude, fucking, those guys used to come to the shop. And it was awesome. Bushwick Bill used to come into that drum and keyboard shop and Scarface and just kick it. Dude, even Carl Lewis used to come there all the time. He would pull up in his red Ferrari and go up to the keyboard department and buy all his shit. This was around the time. This was before he did that
national anthem. That awesome national anthem.
But there were some of the guys in Shalimar,
Mickey Free or who?
I don't remember their names. But yeah, there was a bunch of dudes, you know, once this was probably in the early 90s, you speaking of King's X and Galactic Cowboys, I played in a group called Awful Truth with this guy, David Von Oerking, who moved to Houston from Springfield, Missouri, the same place that the King's X guys moved from.
Uh-huh.
He was pals with all of them and moved to town. And I played in this really killer art rock band with him. Johnny Simmons, who I mentioned earlier, who's a drum teacher that shop, the three of us were that band. But where was I going? Oh, there was a period of time where it felt like everywhere we would go play or everywhere we'd go hang out, it's probably like an 80% chance we'd see Billy Gibbons just hanging out, going and seeing music. So those guys were visible, you know. We didn't have all of the stars like you see when you go out in LA, but there was still some dudes in Houston.
Yeah, it was. I know that I grew up in Corsicana, mm-hmm. but made my way to Denton, and I remember just going to see King's X, and at the basement in Dallas, and then them hanging out and walking up to Doug, and
yeah. Yeah, there was I was in this sort of circle that revolved around them. Doug and I weren't super close, but we were close enough to where one night I ended up in his Camaro, and me and him cruised down to, I think it was the music hall, to go see Crowbar. And actually, me and a couple of his roommate at the time, King's X, this was like 93, I think, whenever the Woodstock was. Was that 94 or 93?
94.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm gonna get myself in trouble, but King's X went to go play that Woodstock, and my buddy that was his roommate happened to have some acid, and so we I actually went and spent the afternoon doing acid at their apartment, and at about the time it started kicking in, we turned the TV on, and it happened to be stuck on MTV, and the King's X performance was on television, and we were all losing our minds at how we could possibly be in Doug's apartment, and he is playing on television. It was a thing that blew our minds for quite some time.
That's pretty cool, though. That's a little bit of your backstory. Let's fast forward a little bit, man. Yeah.
And then I moved to Austin, and
moved to Austin, but you moved out to LA for a bit, right?
Yeah. But that wasn't until the early 2000s.
Okay.
Most of the 90s, I was in Austin. I was in this group called Gowdy, and we ended up being...
You were in Gowdy?
Yeah, I was like, me and Johnny started that thing in like 94 and went through some different folks and ended up finding this great combination with this dude, Jimmy Messer, and Bill Leffler on drums, who I actually went to high school with years before. And we, through, you know, a series of things, ended up being the second group signed to Lars Ulrich's new label that he put together in the late 90s. So in 98, we signed to that label under Elektra, which was a great experience. We crashed and burned, but it was super awesome. And then, you know,
I remember reading a couple of articles.
Killer record.
By Lars, that he just loved your band.
Yeah.
That's how I heard of you guys.
Yeah, he did. You know, it just one of those things where it just didn't work out.
Yeah.
But it was instrumental in me having the successful jaunt to LA that I did. Because after that stopped, the band broke up. Jimmy and Bill moved to LA. I stayed in Austin. I actually got into video games, like making video games, and started working for a company. You know, I was 30 when that ended, and I was like, you know, fuck music. I'm gonna make video games, my second passion. And then that company ran into the ground, and I was left with like, what the hell am I gonna do? And Jimmy and Bill, who had been in LA for a few years, were like, why don't you come out here? And so, yeah, I moved there in the early 2000s. And because of all those years of, you know, a couple of other bands that had label interests that didn't go anywhere, and then the our time with Lars and all that, and all the people I met through there, man, when I moved to LA, I had people looking out for me.
Yeah.
I had people putting me up for stuff. So 6 weeks after moving there, I was on the road. I started playing with the Dan Band, who are the guys from, you know, the old school movie and
all the,
you know,
Will Ferrell movies
and all those Will Ferrell movies. And I moved there. I got the gig with them like a few months after that DVD came out for Old School. And McG, they were doing a twice a month thing at the Paradise, which I think was called the Avalon back then, which I don't know what it's called now, but famous little theater. They would do twice a month over there, two Fridays a month. And it was always like a star studded, like attended event. I met JT there for the first time. He was backstage one night, him and Gila. I got that gig, went on their first ever US tour. That became a regular gig of mine, met a bunch of people, and then, played in a lot of different groups with a lot of, like, I played with, in Lindsay Price's band, who was one of the actresses from 90210. I did some work with Thomas Jane, who's the actor.
The original Punisher.
Met him through my buddy Bill. He was this, wrote these cool little kind of Americana songs. So Thomas Jane, super great guy.
I just watched Boogie Nights the other day, by the way.
He's amazing in Boogie Nights as the tweaker.
Todd.
Yeah. So yeah, you know, meeting all of those people through other friends of mine doing stuff like that. And then a year after I was there, I ended up in Kelly Clarkson's band.
Okay. Who's that?
Yeah, she's this girl. Not many people know her. But yeah, I landed in that gig after they finished her first big record, the Breakaway record, where that 2 years of pushing that record, where they started in a van and then ended up like, since you've been gone and all that stuff just broke. They had finished 2 years of touring, thought they were done. The bass player took another gig. The drummer took another gig. One of the guitar players was fired like at the end of their European leg, which you can see on YouTube, and it's hilarious. And then Ford Motor Company came to them and said, hey, we want to put you back on the road for, you know, 12 weeks or whatever. And so they had to scramble to find people. So they hired Aben Eubanks, guitar player that was in the opening band of their previous thing. They hired Zach Alford to play drums from Bowie's band and B-52s mm-hmm. and all this stuff. He played with Springsteen for a while. And then my dumbass, who my buddy Jimmy Messer from Gowdy was one of the guitar players in her band.
Okay.
And my roommate that I lived with in LA owned a studio in Pasadena with Jason Halbert, their keyboard player. So when it came around, Jason said to Jimmy, like, hey, there's that dude that's always hanging around my studio with Miles. Isn't he your friend that plays bass? And so that kind of, I just got the call.
Right on.
And a week later was in rehearsals and then hit the road with her for what I thought was going to be, you know, just filling in for that. And that ended up being 10 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was it like playing with her? Is she cool?
Super cool. She is someone you never want to bet against. Because whatever it is, she'll crush it. It's incredible. Like, the girl is so competitive. It's hilarious. But on the road, she was really fun. She really made a point to break up any sort of monotony all the time. Whether it was waking up off and getting off the bus and seeing a big, like, bouncy house water slide in the behind the stage for everybody to just goof off on. Or like bowling nights, and like there was always a lot of camaraderie on that. And
I like tours like that. I've been on a couple where
It was always like that. And she was really great about that. Really fun. The band was always great and super fun. They're my closest friends for those 10 years.
Yeah. Right on. Yeah. Right on. You and I met almost a year ago.
Was it October. Only a year ago?
It was a year ago.
Oh, yeah, a year ago.
In Austin.
It was ACL last year.
Yeah. That's when you and I met. We met for a few days. You worked with us for a few days. You got me out of a bind with a bass cab.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But now you're out here on the road with us.
Yeah.
And you're our boss. Yeah. I don't know how I feel about that.
I don't know how I feel about it either.
But you know what? I'll tell you what, after spending all this time with you, there's one thing I really like about you, and I'm gonna say this and then I'll get back to what I like about you. I know friends that were in a band that was on a major label in the 80s. And they did their thing, they had a little success, now they're not doing anything, but you talk to one particular member of this band and you ask him, like, you know, hey, you know, we need a bass player. He's also a bass player. And he always comes up with, yeah, but I need $1,000 a night. I need my own room and this. And this is just local fucking shows here in Dallas. But what I like about you, and I figured this out. I didn't figure it out. I noticed it. Like, you've done it.
Mm-hmm.
You've done the local, the getting signed, the getting dropped. You've toured stadium or arenas with Kelly Clarkson. Yet, you're not good enough to just, like, be a production manager and make the show happen. It's almost like you just want to be around it.
Yeah.
And dude, I respect that so much, because there's not enough of that. You know? Like, you know you've got the chops to play. You know you still got the chops to play and the right attitude to play. And I think that's why it happens for you. But at the same time, you're like, well, if I'm not playing, I'm going to contribute in some other way.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I'm not qualified fucking to do anything else. So there's that, but
there's no plan B.
There's no plan B. Never has been. But you know, even like Kelly was my first taste.
I think a plan B only stifles you.
Yeah, plan B is no good. Yeah, exactly. Plan B only makes you not concentrate on plan A enough.
Exactly.
I think, or at least that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Okay.
But yeah, you know. I was in my 30s before I started consistently being on a tour bus, playing in front of like 20,000 people and stuff like that. So when you really look at, you know, what, 15 years of grinding it out, having side jobs, bartending or fucking whatever else, I think that length of time made it to where being a part of it didn't get lost on me as
you didn't take it for granted.
Yeah. And you know, and just, I like to try and follow that sort of innocent, ignorant arrogance that are my three favorite qualities that you have when you're young, that make you attempt something. And I think that has still, because even in the days when I was playing with Kelly, you know, there'd be times between legs that, you know, like as my roommate at the time, for a lot of that, for like the first half of that, he, Pixie's front of house guy, still is. And, you know, there'd be times when they'd have a little run and Chumpy, their, you know, main tech for Kim and Dave would be on something else and they'd need somebody to go. And I'd go out and tech. And I would do that with different things because it was just a job that I knew that I could make more money in a day that I could do doing anything else.
Yeah.
Back home. And I did think it was funny that I would get a lot of when people on whatever crew I was working in at the time would find out that like I was about to go on another like Kelly Clarkson leg being on stage playing bass.
Yeah.
They'd be like, wow, it's so cool that you're able to like do this. That always seems strange to me. Like, why wouldn't you take an opportunity to get on a tour bus and
earn a living
guitars for somebody?
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, I've thought about that because people have brought that up. Like, oh, it's real special that you're real special for being able to like, it makes me feel like they're saying it's good that you can slum it or something. And it's like, well, go fuck yourself. Like, it's just as important being the person supporting me on stage mm-hmm. as it is me being someone supporting Kelly Clarkson on stage.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, you know, yes, there's no place that I'm more at home than in front of 20,000 people screaming back at me. Yeah. That's such a comfortable place for me to be. But I think the thing that I like the most about being in bands and all that is that gang mentality. It's the group of people, this misfit group of people who are, it's you against the world. Whether you're in a van or whether you're on a tour bus, it's the stuff that happens off stage.
Exactly.
That's the most fun for me. I love being in rehearsal for 12 hours. That's what it was like with Kelly. Like when we rehearsed, we were fucking serious.
Yeah.
We would rehearse for 6 weeks before a tour, 6 days a week, 10 to 12 hours a day, obsessing over the little things. That's how I was with Gowdy. That's how I was with The Awful Truth. That's how I was with Big Deal. That's how I was every little band mm-hmm. to big band that I was that I was really a part of. It's that part that is that's the most fun for me. And so, you know, it's all the stuff that happens on stage for an hour or 2 hours is kind of the icing on the cake. But it's everything else that I like the most. It's sitting here like shooting the shit with you. It's going and eating at fucking Applebee's at next to the Doubletree in fucking Vegas.
You Forgive know? Me.
No, but it's, no, it's no. that stuff. That
no, I agree with you. We spend more awesome. Time with people like ourselves than we do our own family.
Yeah.
And that's why I try to explain it to people, I always say, well, my road family. And I've been with this crew, some of these guys, for 12 years.
Yeah.
And I've, you know, there were times when I did see them, you know, more than my family. And I always, when people ask me what it's like the, you know, it could be the worst day ever, but something happens in that van or on that tour bus or in the hotel lobby with the crew, and then it just turns it all around. It could be the worst day, it turns it all around. And I tell people, if you ever want to try and understand it, there's a scene in a movie called Almost Famous.
Yeah.
when they go get the guitar player and he's all fucked up on acid and they put him in the bus and they're driving and everyone's just pissed off and they start singing
Tiny Dancer.
Tiny Dancer. And then, dude, I get chills thinking about it because that's what it's like. It's something that just, it just says we're all in it together.
Yeah. 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 That's that part of it that is, that's, it's indescribable. But it really is. It really is the thing that I like the most. I like the work. I like the stuff behind the scenes. You know, and again, maybe it has to do with me starting it on the big leagues like later in life. But you know,
well, I think
to love getting up off the bus early and just going and sitting in the stands and watching it all go up.
Dude, I still love doing that.
Yeah,
you know, I love. I used to work for a guy named Josh Ritter, and we did a maybe I shouldn't say the artist's name, but we were in Ireland with a huge artist as support. And after the show was going down, he had played his 3 hours, and we were all backstage and hanging out by the buses and everything. And that artist, it's like 2 a.m, and he comes out of the production office and he gets on his bus and they leave, and I asked his tour manager, he's like, dude, he just loves being around it even after doing what he's done and accomplished and playing 3 hours a night and taking requests from the audience. He just loves being around it.
Yeah,
I love that, man. Yeah. I think that's what I, you know, during the downtime when there were no shows, I miss that the most, just being around it.
Yeah.
I don't think I was ever good enough to play to do it, but I think mentally I knew I didn't want to be, I'm more comfortable making it happen or help, at least helping make it happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
I think that's why I'm, if there's a reason why I'm able to transition to jobs off stage is because, well, I checked off those bucket list items on stage. So I'm not
chasing it.
Yeah, if I'm, you know,
yeah,
like my first tour where I got hired as a guitar tech, was with the Fray, and it was a year that Kelly took a year off, and it was my first summer in a long time where I didn't have any work, so I called my buddy Howard Hopkins, or no, actually Howard called me, the Fray's production manager, at the time. It was like 2014 maybe.
Yeah.
Mm. I had just gotten a kidney removed. It's a whole other story. And I needed work. I needed to pay for the fucking kidney removal. And I didn't have my first sort of summer without a tour. So Howard called me looking for a guitar tech for Dave in the Fray. And I was like, yeah, I got one for you. Me. And he was like, go fuck yourself. I'm not going to hire you as a fucking guitar tech. And I was like, dude, I swear, I need work. And he's like, dude, you're not going to do any good. You're going to be a bass player that's like bummed out that he's not on stage. And you're not going to pull your weight. So I actually had, and I knew the Fray guys. We had toured together with Kelly 2 years prior, and got along great. So, and their manager was even like, I don't know about
iffy
this.
Iffy about it.
Yeah. So I had to write them like a letter. I had to write the manager a letter. But I get it, because you know, I could see how, you know, you have somebody that would be like sort of pining for what that is, whatever. But I never felt that way because, again, like I'd already played Wembley Stadium a couple of times. I'd already done SNL like more than once. I'd already played in front of 80,000 people at a soccer stadium in Brazil. And, you know, all of those things. Massey Hall, Madison Square Garden, Radio City Music Hall, all those things were already checked off. And so I wasn't pining. In fact, I was like, I want to do my best for Dave to be awesome.
Yeah.
And so that's what sort of springboarded. So I didn't stop working for them after that. I would go back and do Kelly tours, and I would go back and work for the Fray, and I would go back and do Kelly tours. And then when the Kelly thing ended, I became more full-time with the Fray, and then, you know, bounced around. I was guitar at stage left tech. I was stage right tech. I became drum tech. Then I started filling in for Howard as production manager. And then the bass player left, and the guys were like, you could probably just get up and play bass with us right now if you wanted. And I was like, yep. And they're like, all right, cool. So should we get another production manager? I was like, nope. I'm going to do both.
Double dip.
Yeah. So, you know, it's to me, it's just to me, whatever it is to be able to be part of the circus is worth it. You
well,
know?
Man, I, you know, we did a really hard short run in September, August, September.
I can't believe I didn't fucking ruin it all. No, I mean, I'm serious. There were so many things. I was already being tour director, production manager for a band as big as Duran Duran. I'd never done anything, organized anything in that capacity before. I was, you know, one truck, couple of buses kind of thing. This was much bigger with a much bigger band, which much more on the line. And, you know, I was nervous as hell. But luckily, the thing that made me feel good every day was whoever I saw first, whether it was you or Kev or Oz or Phil, every day, one of you guys, the first thing out of one of your mouths was, got you back. Every day. And that really got me through the day a lot. And there was a lot of fucking curveballs. You know, we lost Skippy, you know, due to health reasons. We lost, we had some snafus where we weren't going to show up to a place in time and, you know, had to organize like gear to be there ahead. It's all these things that I'd never done before that could have derailed the whole thing. You know, luckily worked out. But it was a lot of fun and I want to keep doing it.
Yeah. Well, man, I tell you what, like you said, you know, what's the saying in this industry? I fucked up bigger gigs than this.
Yeah.
You had plenty of chances to screw it up.
Yeah.
And you didn't. And one thing that I always, when anyone would ask me about you, I'd say, dude, that dude never cracks. Like, he's always got a smile on his face. Whatever's going on, I see people yelling at you and you're just like,
yeah,
you know, calm. Yeah. Because I'm not that guy. If somebody yells at me, I yell louder.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. It's like dogs barking at each other.
Yeah.
Know? But, you know, I think they made the right choice in bringing you in. We've had a lot of fun with you. I'm sorry to tell you on the podcast, but you're fired. No, man. But, you know, dude, like you made it to where we didn't question, like, is it going to get done? Like, we knew you were getting it done. There's been times when we've had guys more experienced than you, man, and we're like, I'm not fucking sure about this.
Well, you know, it helps that it's a really good group of guys and gals on that crew. But also it's not, you know, it would be different if it was a group whose music I didn't have a very, very deep connection with. That part of it was huge. You know, when we talk about bass players, I can't believe I didn't mention JT as one of my dudes.
I can't believe you didn't either, man.
Which is crazy. Maybe it's just because he's in front of my face right now. But that's a guy that reinvented the game. That's a guy that I aspired to be like. Or at least aspire to understand the instrument the way that guy does. Like, you want to talk about iconic bass lines. There's not a lot of songs out there that girls like the bass line to.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That there's not a lot of bands out there. It's kind of like the way that, you know, more people air drum to Rush than air guitar to Rush. More people air bass to Duran Duran than anything else. And that's a real rarity. Yeah. But it's because of those iconic bass lines. Everybody, you know, does the air pop on Hungry Like the Wolf. But that was a huge motivating factor, is like, this is an iconic band for me. But also for the rest of the world, about to be inducted into the Hall of Fame. So there's your fucking proof right there. But it was, it was making sure that I got to hear all of those songs tomorrow night that made me want to do a good job.
Yeah. Well, you did a great job. You didn't do a good job. And I'm not kissing your ass. And you did a great job. Man, thanks for taking time to talk to me today.
No, this is fun. You can see, like, I have no problem talking about fucking myself.
No. No, it's been great, man. We had a great day today in Vegas.
Yeah, like you said, it wasn't bad.
We got caught in some dust storms.
157,000 mile an hour winds.
It was pretty hard out there. And then we enjoyed some delicious Applebee's.
Yeah. Proud sponsor of the...
Is Breakfast Included.
No, I need to find out if breakfast is included. By the way, it's supposed to be.
I think we have a voucher.
Oh, we have a voucher.
We have a voucher, ladies and gentlemen.
We did have those awesome DoubleTree cookies.
That was a
look at all these names we're dropping, and none of them will throw money.
None of
at
them
us.
Are sponsoring. They need to.
Yeah, I'll just bleep it out. Anyway, well, man, you know it's called Is Breakfast Included. So if it was included, what would you have?
Oh, if it was included, I would probably. I mean, I'm kind of a basic breakfast guy, although I do love a good cereal buffet. If there's a variety of cereals, I'm super happy. But for sure, if there's eggs and bacon down there, I'm taking those down.
Yeah.
We're probably not going to be so lucky to have biscuits and gravy. That only happens in very, very select cities, unfortunately. But, you know, my favorite thing about touring in Europe is absolutely breakfast.
A lot of people say that.
I mean, full English breakfast could be my favorite food.
Sorry, guys.
And I'm talking about all of it. Like, black pudding, one of my favorite things to have for breakfast.
That's a first.
But the spreads of breakfast in the UK and throughout Europe, no US hotel comes close to those hotels' breakfast. And it really is. Like, if I was going to list what are my favorite things about touring overseas, breakfast is number one.
Yeah. You know, there's places now that on the menu, you'll go in and order like breakfast and it'll say like pancakes, American pancakes.
Yeah.
They're trying to be like us, man.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, you stick with your crepes or whatever y'all sell.
Yeah. Well, man, thanks a lot. And, man, we're going to do it. We got a couple of shows and Hall of Fame.
Got a couple of shows and Hall of Fame. That's kind of awesome. Judas Priest. Unfortunately, Devo didn't make it, but Eminem did. I'm really excited to see Eminem.
Lionel Richie,
Eurythmics.
Pat Benatar. And I believe, Gerardo. I think it airs November 19th.
Oh, yeah, I didn't even ask that question. It's not live on HBO.
No, it's not live. Okay. But I think it airs on November 19th, which this will come out before November 19th.
And so, do you have to? It is HBO?
Yeah, tune in to HBO Max. You got to get HBO Max.
Oh, I think
Max.
I have that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If not, I'll lend you my password.
Yeah. Don't say it on don't say it here.
All right, man. Later.
All right, later. Thanks.
Right on. Einar Peterson III. You can find him on Instagram at Anarchy. You'll have to figure out how to spell that if you want to find him. Make you do your own research. Anyway, what did I say? Great guy, right? Hilarious. And who he was talking to me, he didn't put on an act or anything. That's who he is. All right, guys, I'm done. Have a great day, and we'll be back next week.